perpetrated by the apartheid Israeli regime in the occupied territories.
Increased settler violence around the settlements, clashes at the holy sites in Jerusalem during the Ramadan, forced evictions and demolitions in the West Bank, including of EU-funded projects.
Tel Aviv has been urged to fully cooperate with an independent inquiry into Shireen's murder. The EU says that's important in order to maintain the bloc's close partnership with Israel.
When situations like this arise, we say it is very important for this partnership to continue in its high quality, that we have clarity about things that are happening, which are actually against our principles and our values.
EU legislators urge the West not to give up on the idea of a two-state solution to end the Israel-Palestine conflict.
The tragic death of Shireen Abu Akleh is a sad reminder of the spiral violence taking place that continues to haunt this region.
The European Parliament debate heard that Israel has killed around 50 Palestinian journalists during the past two decades. It goes without saying then that Shireen was not the first and almost certainly will not be the last. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Months after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, the U.S. Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or SIGAR, confessed that Washington was mainly to blame for the collapse of the former Afghan government and national security and defense forces. The report by SIGAR reveals that Afghan forces' morale were destroyed after then-U.S. President Donald Trump reached a deal with the Taliban in 2020, and President Joe Biden affirmed the U.S. withdrawal in 2021.
In my opinion, the Doha deal paved the way for the U.S.-led foreign forces' withdrawal from Afghanistan. It also gave the Taliban forces the belief that they can take over Afghanistan easily. In fact, the Doha deal and the U.S. withdrawal both were great achievements for the Taliban and Afghanistan.
Former Afghan generals and experts also told the agency that most American support to Afghan forces was stopped or limited, while the Taliban had intensified attacks.
I agree with the SIGAR report. The former Afghan Republic government was defeated when the U.S. signed a deal with the Taliban. After the Doha deal, the U.S. stopped its major logistic support, including fuel, rockets, arms, and air support to Afghan forces. It continued until the Afghan army completely ran out of equipment.
SIGAR notes that in essence, U.S. and Afghan efforts to cultivate an effective and sustainable security assistance sector were likely to fail from the beginning. Afghan experts also say that the U.S. never meant to build a nation or a state in the country, and all Western-backed armies are doomed to failure.
The former Afghan government was an example of American state-building. They invaded our country, formed their own government, and finally demolished it. They never meant to boost the state-nation process. The Americans appointed their own men to the Afghan government, while they were not representing Afghan people. In addition, the U.S. intentionally established a corrupt and dependent army in Afghanistan.
The Taliban took over Afghanistan in August 2021 as the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan and the former Western-backed government collapsed. Afghans are angry with the U.S. for pushing Afghanistan into a dire situation. People here believe Washington not only betrayed Afghans but also continues to harm them with sanctions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In Indian-controlled Kashmir, a recent order by the authorities is giving sleepless nights to many business owners and shopkeepers. Business owners, big and small, are spending hundreds of dollars each to install security cameras, a mandatory move ordered by the authorities. The official order says the scheme will deter criminals, antisocial and anti-national elements. The order also outlines the minimum standards for camera resolution, infrared capability and range. The government's order has been highly criticized by business owners. They describe the move as a callous approach towards war-weary Kashmir's fractured business establishments, which were deeply dented after India cancelled Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019.
Everybody knows the quantum of the business, it's almost 80% down. It was their duty to install the CC camera. Why to tell to the business you install the CCTV cameras? You see, the 80% of the business company, they cannot afford to install this CCTV camera. So I think they should review this decision and they should look into this.
Muzaffar Jan, a shop owner in the heart of Srinagar's busiest market, Lal Chowk, says it has been days since he has seen a customer at his store. However, to follow the police instructions, he was forced to pull out the money he had saved for running his household.
I waited for around a week to see whether others would install cameras. Later, I was forced because of continuous announcements and strict orders. I installed the camera. It took me around $1,000, and not everyone can afford this cost. In Kashmir, there are frequent power cuts, and to keep the camera plugged in, I had to install an uninterrupted power supply inverter. Many of us can't manage two meals a day. How can we afford these cameras?
The order further instructs that the cameras installed at the business owner's expense must always stay on. The system should record and store footage for 30 days and must be produced on demand of police and other law enforcement agencies without any court order. And failure to abide by the order will result in a fine or month-long imprisonment. The level of surveillance in Kashmir is increasing day by day. Authorities argue that the measure will help them protect people's lives. But Kashmiris are calling the move as a worrying development and see it as a threat to their human rights, privacy and dignity. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Much of Mariupol may lie in ruins, but the city is already coming back to life after months of fierce fighting. A market is open, selling all essential goods, and humanitarian aid is being distributed by organizations associated with the Russian government.
These days, the situation is more or less stabilized. People are fed. There are more problems with water, electricity and gas in some parts, and there are still problems with basic domestic needs.
Amongst the ruins, I came across a gathering who are waiting for a drop-off of humanitarian supplies.
During the fighting, I was at home. When there were battles, the house was shaking. I stood with my back to the wall and I was shaking with the wall. When I think of it, I still shiver. There was nothing good about the fighting. We don't want anything except peace and quiet now.
Population of Mariupol before the war was about 450,000. Now, it's hard to estimate, but we think around a third of those people still remain, either stayed during the battle or stayed nearby the city in camps and have now returned. Over the next days, weeks, months, years, we can expect many thousands of people to return here to Mariupol. But who will be those people? Before the conflict began, the city was very mixed between pro-Russian, Russian-speaking people and more Ukrainian nationalist, pro-Ukrainian people. Now that it's under Russian control, as long as it stays under Russian control, we can expect many of the Russian people to come back. But for the Ukrainians, they may well stay away, which means that the ethnic diversity in the city, the ethnic makeup of the city, will change.
It is not yet time to be happy about anything. But there are certain expectations that Russia is a rich country, and its politics are more independent, and we hope things will improve.
How do you feel living under Russian rule now rather than Ukrainian?
You see, we cannot say anything yet. We don't understand anything yet. We only want it to be peaceful and quiet. That's what people want here. What else can we say?
Like many people I speak to in areas recently taken over by Russia, she is scared to answer such questions. She may be more pro-Ukrainian, or she might be worried that Russia might not be in control of Mariupol for long. Down by the port area, I found the incongruous sight of fishermen, seemingly oblivious to the fact that war was still raging across the country.
Of course I am happy. Of course. Truth to tell, we've been waiting for it for a long time. Of course, yes, I'm happy to be under Russian control now, because we have become free. Well, we were free before, but not in this way. The attitude changed. People have a different attitude to each other now. Earlier, we were afraid to say things and speak our minds. Yes, I could get into trouble if I criticized the Ukrainian government.
This is commonly heard amongst Russian speakers here, that they have been marginalized and persecuted by the increasingly nationalist Ukrainian government. This is the reason the East rose up 8 years ago, and why many here welcome the Russians. Unless Ukraine takes back Mariupol, it will now likely be populated predominantly
by an ethnic Russian population. Whatever the fate of this city, it will never be the same again. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
The controversial idea of creating an EU army has now come to pass in all but name. The European Commission confirmed on Wednesday the bloc's 27 nations have agreed to jointly spend €200 billion on military hardware over the next few years.
Joint procurement is better operationally for our armed forces, because this strengthens the interoperability between the armed forces.
Citizens are struggling to survive, mainly due to the economic fallout from the conflict in Ukraine. But it appears EU authorities have other priorities.
We need modern air defences. We need drones. We need air-to-air refuelling capabilities. We need tanks and armoured vehicles. We need coastal defence.
Anti-war demonstrators in Brussels say the extra billions being spent on NATO and the EU army cannot be justified.
Just those people are saying that we have to secure ourselves. Against who? Against what? Against, I don't know.
We want Belgium out of NATO, and we want NATO out of Belgium.
The European Commission insists the EU's military spending plan will complement the work of NATO, not erode it. But military experts are saying that is inevitable. And they say the project has already seriously undermined NATO's credibility. The Commission has also just announced an additional €9 billion for the Ukrainian government.
Since the beginning of Russia's aggression on 24th of February, the EU has provided €4.1 billion to help Ukraine.
Hard-pressed EU taxpayers might wonder how the money will be spent. Last September, the bloc's financial watchdog revealed how corruption is rife in Ukraine at every level, from the government to the judiciary. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Hamas government media office has held a big ceremony in Gaza to pay tribute to fallen Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh. Abu Akleh was killed after being shot in the head while covering Israeli army raids in the northern occupied West Bank last week. Palestinian journalists, academics, and senior Palestinian officials attended the ceremony. Palestinian officials accused Israeli regime forces of deliberately killing Shirin Abu Akleh.
Shirin was killed in cold blood, like many Palestinian journalists. Israeli forces have killed some 50 Palestinian journalists during the last 22 years. We demand that Israeli leaders be held accountable for their crimes against Palestinian journalists.
Abu Akleh was wearing a press vest that identified her as a member of the press when she was shot by Israeli snipers. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, protective gear that clearly indicates individuals are journalists should grant them extra protection, not make them targets.
We demand, and I think the international community should all demand justice for Shirin Abu Akleh. What is happening from the Israeli occupation, the constant targeting of journalists, is not, it's just a systematic, ongoing, punitive reaction that keeps on going. It has been going on for so long, and it still is continuing.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye. Under the Geneva Conventions, journalists, like other civilians, enjoy protection amid armed conflicts.
I believe that, you know, killing Shirin Abu Akleh was not the first crime that the Israeli occupation has committed, and it won't be the last one. I believe that as long as there is a military occupation of the Palestinian territories, these crimes won't stop, especially against Palestinian journalists.
While covering Israeli attacks, Palestinian journalists work hard to avoid being part of the story themselves.
Observers say that Shirin Abu Akleh's killing is another example of the Israeli regime's brutality against the Palestinian people. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee, the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the Ukraine conflict, there have been some major gains made by the Russian army, unlike what is being reported by the Western media. For example, the port city of Mariupol is now under full Russian control. This is while the Ukrainian Prime Minister Zelensky has said only diplomacy can end the war, unlike its partners like the U.S., who just got the green light for another $40 billion in military aid. Meanwhile, the world is suffering from food shortages and record inflation. Well, these are just some of the angles we'll be covering in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Political analyst and blogger at The Polemicist, Jim Kavanaugh, joins us from New York. Also joining us is political analyst Rusia Segodnya from Rustam Safronov, who joins us from Moscow.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Jim Kavanaugh, taking a look at the military advancements that has been made by Russia. Basically, the siege of the Azovstal is over, and it is reported that Russia is in full control of Mariupol. First of all, why is that deemed to be Russia's biggest victory yet, as it has been described?
Mariupol was the strongest redoubt of the Azov battalion, who were the most dedicated and vicious fighters on behalf of the Ukrainian, of the Kiev government. And there was an enormous number of fighters that were taken prisoner. I think it was almost 2,500 came out over the past few days and surrendered unconditionally to the Donbas and Russian troops. And that was a surrender, not an evacuation, as the American press presented it. So it demonstrates that, you know, it took a long time. It took longer than maybe that Russians wanted or thought it would, but the Russians worked methodically for that victory, and it's a big victory, and it's going.
Okay, it seems like we may have lost our guest there. Rostam, let me ask you about how this gives Russia the advantage that it was looking for, and not only that, looking at the way that this at this point may then lead Russia to move into the Donbas region as a whole. I'm guessing that is the next military maneuver or strategy that Russia has. And if so, if it does take over Donbass, does that give an indication that perhaps the war is going to be over? I mean, is that Russia's military objective in this war?
Well, I think it's minimum what Russia wants to get. That's liberation of Donbass from Ukrainian control, and giving how Russia would present that the people of Donbass a right to decide their destiny. Do they want to be independent or to be with Russia? But certainly not under Kiev control. Would Russia go further and continue advancing to another areas of Ukraine, trying to occupy, for example, entire coast of the Black Sea? That's remain to be seen. The question is the position of Kiev government. They do not want to give up. They do not recognize Russian rights to control the destiny of Donbass, and even don't want to give up in Crimea. All of that making truce in near future impossible. What Mariupol meant, that's a big chunk of military force what Ukraine has, finally was substantially tarnished, diminished, because that so-called die-hard, almost like Ukrainian SS fighters, which used to not supposed to surrender and whatever, they used to be glorified, very dedicated, very much brainwashed with a semi-nationalistic, almost Nazi propaganda. Finally, they have to give up, and it's giving Russia some moral advantage. Okay. I mean, military too, because defense of Azovstal plant was a huge military event and siege of that, and it was distract a lot of Russian forces from advancing to entire area of Donbass. They used to be paralyzed there because, you know, tied up, tangled up. So now it's over, and it will help to liberate some forces for further advances. So that's how I'm seeing the situation.
So that's one way of looking at it, Jim Kavanaugh. But the other way that mainly Western media is depicting this, and we're trying to just get to the bottom of what's going on militarily, is that this war has been, or special military operation has been a failure when it comes to Russia. We know, and I'm sure you're familiar with how it's been described as what was supposed to be a lightning conquest, as it's been written. But yet it's been somewhat drawn out, and Russia has been unable to take the capital, Kyiv, seen as a failure and a pullback of forces. But based on what we're seeing today, I mean, that's not a military failure on the part of Russia. Are the online, whether online or any other description of Russia failing military, just meant to hamper and disappoint the Russian morale, so to speak?
Well, it's meant to gin up support in the West and in the United States for a fight that they believe they can win. We have, I think it's the case, and I don't think, you know, I don't want to pretend not to recognize that the things didn't go as quickly as Russia probably thought they would, and that many people who were supporters of the Russian cause here thought it would. But I think that, you know, when you look at the real deep military situation, the Russians are achieving their objectives. And the primary objective wasn't to, the defeat of an enemy doesn't happen because you take cities, it happens because you destroy their military. And this is what the Russians have been methodically doing, destroying the Ukrainian military apparatus from its logistics and its ability to resupply and its communications possibilities, et cetera. And the Russians really want to secure the Donbass republics. They want to secure the coast, and they've been largely successful on that. So the thing that's been happening in the United States and in the West is, you know, tactical retreats, changes of position, movements of have been portrayed as Russia's losing. And that has encouraged a lot of people to say, we have to fight, and American politicians, we can fight this to win it, and not only to help Ukraine, but to weaken Russia. I think that's a fantasy and a very dangerous one that is getting us into a very close to a third world war.
All right, now comes one of the key questions that I'm hoping that you can answer, Rustam, and that is how it has been reported that the Azov fighters, of which it has been described to be far right, and perhaps you can expand on that more for us, is said to have had an impact or an effect in this conflict. Please tell us about the Azov fighters, who they are, what does their capture mean, how many numbers there are, and whether one of the main reasons that Putin went into this special military operation was, as he said, to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. This has been talked about, but now that they have been captured, many of them, tell us what it means in terms of the war.
Well, it used to be a few thousands of fighters of Azov, very elite and very well trained and equipped, not even a detachment, it's almost brigade, so because it was increasing and recruiting new members, and it was very prestigious to serve in that detachment. That were highly motivated military men, volunteers, soldiers, convinced nationalists. A lot of them right now, when they used to be searched during the surrender, have in their body tattoo of the Hitler swastika, pictures of Stepan Bandera. One of those individuals, I think with the name of David Kasatkin or something like that, he had a sign additionally to everything else, to different kind of slogans and words and swastika. He had also sign, kill all of them. So it's like a soldier who was looking at him saying, like, who do you really want to kill? Like, who all, like, whatever, entire people in the face of the earth. So that was very motivated people. And generally speaking, in Ukrainian military forces after 2014, when Russia took over Crimea, new Ukrainian authorities put a lot of emphasis into the nationalistic spirit of Ukrainian army. First of all, they moved from the east all military schools to Lvov, to that area, to Ternopil, Ivano-Frankivsk, to the west. And they inserted special political commissars from the western part of Ukraine, which is traditionally much more nationalistic, into military structure to be able to discipline and boost morale in nationalistic way. So Azov was a core of all of that. That's why Azov was defending biggest city in the area of Donbass, which rebellion republics wasn't able to conquer. So. Mm-hmm. That's why the failure of Azov meant so much. I told you before, it's almost like SS used to be in Nazi Germany.
Right, Azov. Well, that's how it's been described. And Jim Kavanaugh, Ukraine is the world's only nation to actually have this neo-Nazi formation within its military ranks. And again, as our guest there talked about them, they are very capable to earn that. And that is perhaps why the Russian President Vladimir Putin has said that they are the ones that are being targeted. But again, the picture that's being painted is not as such when you listen to Western media, that Putin's just out of his mind to even mention this, and that's just some kind of, I don't know, illusion or delusion that the Russian president has. What are your thoughts on the fact that now the arrest of and the death of some of these Azov fighters is a factor in this war?
Well, it is a factor. It's always been a factor, and but your point is valid. I don't know to the extent to which the West and Western media is willing to recognize this. I mean, the Azov Battalion is one of a number of really fascistic battalions, and these are groups, the political groups that whose legacy goes back to fighting with Hitler in the Second World War, and they're not ashamed of it. They're proud of it, and they boast about it, and they call themselves Nazis. So, and you do have a relationship between You know, the fascist groups around the world, especially in Europe, look to them because, as you say, this is the only nation in the world where these groups are highly integrated into the state apparatus and the military apparatus. And they've changed the ideological framework and climate of the country since 2014. So, you know, you have groups around the world that look to them for inspiration. The Buffalo shooter in New York, last week in New York, took his inspiration from the Christchurch, New Zealand shooter, who took his inspiration from the Azov battalion, whom he visited in Ukraine. And you have the fact that if these groups win, that's going to be an impetus and it's going to be an inspiration to fascist groups around the world. And if they lose, that's going to be a defeat for them. So this is part of what's going on here, and it's an important part.
Yeah, and that's not a narrative that you're going to hear. What you just said is not something you're going to hear specifically in Western media. Okay, let's take a look at another development here, Rustam, and that is the fact that you're looking at Finland and Sweden and the membership to NATO. Now, the question I have is not just these two countries, but the way that they are going about becoming a member, the incentive behind it. Do you think that there is some kind of scaremongering tactics that perhaps the U.S. is using for countries, European countries, like these two, that say, listen, if you don't join NATO, you could be next, something to that effect, in order not only to get weapon sales, but also obviously to have membership dues, because obviously we know they have to pay that to the NATO organization.
Well, you're right about that, absolutely. In one point, when president was Mr. Donald Trump, he used to argue all the time, Europe and this rich nation of Europe do not contribute enough in all these defense apparatus security issues in Europe. They do not pay enough. Why only Americans have to carry that way, this weight? And all these leads would be useful for the United States. But I wouldn't deny a natural fear of that nation's in general atmosphere, because we have to admit majority of so-called civilized world, Western world, they portray that action of Russia as an aggression, and conversations like narrative, oh, you're the next, it's very much spread around the people who want to be scared. I mean, like, for example, some nationalists in Central Asia saying, oh, Kazakhstan going to be the next, you know, let's like whatever, move further away from Russia. I wanna, like in European nations saying, oh, next thing like Putin will take over Baltic republics. Of course, all of that seems to me as a very big exaggeration, and Russia doesn't have energy or drive for that. With Ukraine, it was a different story. It was a combination of two factors. Yes, Russia, Kremlin are considering armament of Ukraine and attempt to join the NATO as an existential threat. But it was especially painful and dangerous because, yes, Mr. Putin and a lot of people in Russia thinking, we grow up from the one root, these three nations, Russians, Belarusians, and Ukrainians. They're almost the same. They're almost one people, not exactly, but almost. So, and for them especially, they drive to the West. That's especially upsetting, treacherous thing, which has to be prevented by any cost. That's what contribute into that special military operation, mm-hmm. As a rationale, as a... Well, Finland and Sweden, Putin said, like, we don't really care about so much. I mean, it's bad, but we don't have anything against these nations, and we're not like, yes, we do. We will create necessary step, move troops, whatever, create different bases in the border, but it's not where we're seeing dangers from. You could see, like, Ukraine with Azov, with a very powerful nationalistic rhetoric, with a suppressing Russian-speaking population in Donbass seems being much more dangerous to Kremlin. That's okay. Why it's a different story.
All right, so here we have Zelensky. Aside from the fact that it watches as countries join NATO within a span of a very short period of time, And aside from the fact that the EU is not prepared to have membership for it, it says, Zelensky is saying, a diplomatic solution is still possible. Diplomacy is the only way to end the war. Well, that's fine and dandy, but then you have the U.S. got another $40 billion just approved, and you still have the push for a military solution to come not only from the U.S., but obviously it leading the pack of NATO countries, NATO member countries. What is the story there? Do you think Zelensky, Jim Kavanaugh, wants some kind of negotiations now, or is he just saying that and he has to follow whoever is ordering him?
I think that Zelensky is not in control of the situation, and I think that you'd have to be silly to not think that he's every day on the phone and zooming call with his handlers in Washington and the CIA and American embassy, and he's under pressure from the right-wing fascists in Ukraine who do not want to settle this with Russia. Look, there was a diplomatic situation. This is the whole point. There was a diplomatic situation that was arrived at 8 years ago, and he was elected as president a couple of years ago to implement it, and he couldn't do it. And the United States doesn't want the war to stop, and the right-wing fascists don't want a war to stop, and his own senior advisor is on the record. You can see it on the internet saying a war with Russia is the only way we're going to get into NATO. So there is it's very difficult because the diplomatic solution, which is neutrality for Ukraine, no NATO, recognize Crimea as Russian and the Donbass republics as independent, is what Russia is after, and they're not going to stop. If they don't get that, they've lost. And if Ukraine gives that up, they have lost. This is quite clear. One side or the other of this is going to suffer a decisive defeat, and it cannot be hidden. And that's why, you know, this idea of a diplomatic solution is fine. There was one that could have worked, which would have kept the Donbass republics as autonomous regions within a unified Ukrainian state. That was destroyed by Ukraine.
All right, Rustam, looking at the goal that the U.S. has, as it has stated, even though we know that really the real goal, which it has also stated, being that it wants Russia to be militarily defeated, but it also wants Russia to have total devastation economically. Now, it's pushing really hard for that. In some ways, it has been successful. But when you take a look at how the Russian ruble, for example, is now the world's top performing currency for the year 2022, up 11% against the dollar, and you're still looking at EU countries buying the oil, and it is there are even talks of other commodities being added to the payment in ruble scheme, such as wheat maybe and meat. Do you think that U.S. then is defeated in its intentions when it comes to the sanctions regime against Russia?
You know, United States is a very powerful country. And it has a lot of capacities still. I wouldn't say it's United States is defeated. They could just become little more practical and stop these attempts totally destroy Russia by trying to drone more and more Russian Ukraine into that war. That would be maybe more practical solution. But so far, the idea of like Reagan did to make Russia as bleed as possible during the war, and finally to destroy Russia economically and maybe politically as well, because obviously if Russia would lose, that would be not only the end of the Mr. Putin, that would be the end of contemporary political structure in Russia, and it could encourage different process of disintegration of Russia and so on. So what everybody is terrified in Russia to lose, because it could stimulate the process like happened in 1991 with the destruction of the Soviet Union. So far we don't, I mean, like we see the first steps of American realism. For example, they refused to give some advanced weapons to Ukraine last time. because they feel like it could be spread to the territory of a Russian Federation, which already Ukraine trying to do. In this point, if Russia feels too desperate, it could use tactical nuclear weapon, and it could lead to world disaster, nuclear war. So I don't think United States are interested to have that sort All right. of outcome.
All right. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, Jim Kavanaugh from New York, the polemicist, political analyst, and blogger. Political analyst there at Russia Segodnya, Rustam Safrona from Moscow. And that is for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tatway and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
An investigation reveals the immigration agency has collected data on most Americans. It's the latest case in a worrying trend, says Farah Hassan, a foreign policy in focus contributor, in an article published under the heading, ICE is spying on American people. Here's more. Almost 1,200 innocent people, mostly Muslims, were rounded up and detained after the September 11 attacks, often for months without charges. Arabs and South Asians were racially profiled and deported for minor immigration violations. The FBI began surveilling mosques across America. As part of the Homeland Security reforms following 9/11, the U.S. Congress created the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement ICE agency in 2003 to ostensibly fight terrorism and enforce immigration law. But the truth is, ICE went on to use its newly established authority to spy on nearly everyone across the United States of America. An independent two-year investigation has now revealed that ICE collected data on hundreds of millions of Americans under a legally and ethically questionable surveillance system, largely outside of public oversight. Georgetown Law Center on Privacy and Technology uncovered this dragnet after filing over 200 Freedom of Information Act requests and reviewing ICE's contracting records from 2008 to 2021. In its report released on May 10th, the center found that ICE has spied on most Americans without a warrant and circumvented many state privacy laws, such as those in California. The authors conclude ICE now operates as a domestic surveillance agency. ICE has carried out this surveillance by turning a third parties like state departments of motor vehicles, large utility companies, and private data brokers like LexisNexis Risk Solutions. From these sources, ICE gained access to drivers' license data for 3 in 4 adults living in the United States and scanned a third of the license photos with facial recognition technology. ICE is also able to view over 218 million utility customers' records across the U.S., including for over half of California's residents. This surveillance network has unsurprisingly hit immigrant communities hardest. The agency has targeted immigrants for deportation by cruelly exploiting their trust in public institutions, such as when undocumented people apply for a driver's license or sign up for essential utilities like water and electricity. These practices point to an agency that has clearly overstepped its boundaries. ICE does not have the congressional authority to do this kind of bulk data collection on the public. This overreach underscores the need to shift U.S. immigration law away from a deportation-driven status quo. Unfortunately, this ICE program isn't an isolated case. It's part of a broader domestic surveillance apparatus that spans decades and multiple federal agencies, including the FBI, CIA, and NSA, and ultimately impacts all of Americans. During the 1960s and 70s, federal agencies spied on anti-Vietnam War protesters and civil rights leaders. More recently, in 2013, whistleblower Edward Snowden revealed that the National Security Agency created a massive surveillance program that secretly gathered telephone records on millions of Americans, regardless of whether they were suspected of any wrongdoing. And this February, newly declassified documents exposed the CIA's own secret bulk data collection program to spy on Americans. The type of data remains classified, but Senators Ron Wyden and Martin Heinrich have called for greater transparency on the agency's surveillance of Americans. Americans should all be alarmed by this growing domestic surveillance state. Left unchecked, it corrodes public trust in U.S. democratic institutions and undermines U.S. civil liberties, most notably the embattled right to privacy. The history of the U.S. regime surveillance demonstrates that Americans can never take this right for granted.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.